She was fond of quoting, "The crests of evil are as rare as the crests of good, and that most so-called black magic was just dirty grey." The truth is that she had a rather low opinion of many of her occult contemporaries, believing them to be too ineffectual for either good or evil. It was in her initial research into occult abuses that she became aware of the existence of an inner plane and an outer organization of initiates which was called the Occult Police. Most of its operations were on the inner planes with adepti whose job it was to try to seek out occult abuse and spiritual wickedness and then to put an end to it wherever possible. Certain occult groups in the physical world had their own inner section to work with the occult police, and these were called hunting lodges. They were the physical plane terminals for the inner plane occult police organization. Another inner plane group to help control abuse was called the Watchers. They seemed to act as part of the occult police, and their specific role seemed to be to seek out occult abuse, misuse of the powers of the mind, and general misconduct in the field. The Watchers would then hand over the information either to the occult police or to suitable individuals on the physical plane who would then take the necessary action to put the matter right. The Watchers appeared to spend their time searching out abuse and did not actually act to correct it, they passed it on. The Watchers and the occult police did not die with the unfortune, in fact, they are still very much in evidence. One example of this was that there had been some rather bad misuse of certain occult powers by a man who ran a small lodge from his house near Cambridge. This man said that he was a black occultist and that he could exercise considerable power over people, as well as bring them wealth and everything they desired. Not a terribly prepossessing figure in his own right, he nevertheless enjoyed considerable popularity for a time. Unfortunately, he used animals, and one of the things he did was to torture them ritually. The Watchers had been aware of his activities but had not been able to learn his name or the location of his lodge until he was arrested for some trivial local offense. When the inspectors looked over his house, they found the temple and the story of his activities appeared in one of the popular newspapers. A copy of the paper was left upon the seat of a railway train leaving Cambridge and was found by a good occultist whom the Watchers had alerted. Now, with the name and the address of the man known, it was a simple matter to call it to the attention of the occult police. Within 3 days, the man was arrested for indecent assault, prosecuted and sentenced. He was completely removed from the scene and the temple was dismantled. This is a clear indication of the sort of cleaning up action that continually goes on. The Watchers make the initial discovery as it were and bring the matter to the attention either of the occult police or to someone on the physical plane who is capable of action. Then corrective action is taken. The circumstances are sometimes very strange, but the poison is removed. Dionne Fortune was instructed in the procedure to use should she ever need to get in touch with the occult police to report abuse or to ask for protection. She was told that she should visualize a black Calvary cross with a circle imposed upon it, similar to the Celtic cross, against a scarlet-red background, while mentally or clairvoyantly calling for help. This is the legitimate symbol for that purpose and should never be used except in time of need or emergency. While using the resources of this inner organization, Dionne Fortune was able to obtain a great deal of information about occult malpractice, as the occult police headquarters seemed to be the clearinghouse for all messages. Her connection with the occult police continued throughout her lifetime, and it was always her wish that when the Society of the Inner Light was well established, that they would be able to set up their own hunting lodge to be affiliated with the inner occult police organization. Next headline is The Golden Dawn. During World War I, Dionne Fortune was again being depleted of energy and suffering from recurring spells of mental exhaustion, which undoubtedly was a throwback from her encounter with the directors of the commercial school. The work she was doing as a lay Freudian analyst was occupying more and more of her time. World War I ended and Dionne Fortune had renewed her links with the Theosophical Society while moving away from the close association with Dr. Moriarty. It was at this time that Dionne Fortune met one of the members of a Brodyness offshoot of the Golden Dawn, the Alpha et Omega. Innes was a writer and his works were very popular at the time. He would write mostly about mystical subjects, generally along the lines of the Celtic tradition and the elementals. Brodyness did not run a breakaway movement from the Golden Dawn. He was quite well regarded within that organization and was allowed to run his own particular version of the Golden Dawn system and was given considerable latitude to do so. He certainly was not a bad ogre and in no way was it schismatic. His group was the Alpha et Omega and was a duly accredited branch of the main order. The lodge in the Western Supermare area was an Ines-type lodge and followed his modified system. With the encouragement of her new acquaintance, Dion Fortune decided that the correct thing for her was to enter an organized magical group of the Western tradition and proceeded to join the Ines Lodge of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. She was accepted and initiated into Alpha et Omega about the end of World War I, and immediately following the ceremony, her problems of energy depletion and mental prostration vanished, and never returned. Apparently what had happened was that in the course of the peculiar type of etheric hypnotism practiced BV the headmistress of the commercial school, Dion Fortune's aura had been damaged and leaked in the way that a faulty vessel will leak. Hence, energy was being perpetually lost and she was also prone, in a reverse way, to the invasion of negative forces through the same faulty part of her aura. As far as we know, Dion Fortune was a model neophyte within the Golden Dawn until she decided that the people who ran that particular lodge knew very little about the inner workings of what they were doing. One description was that they were a set of bearded old men more interested in the antiquities than in the living force of the tradition. She asked more and more questions and got fewer and fewer satisfactory answers. In 1920, Dion Fortune moved to London and transferred to the branch of the Alpha et Omega under Maya Curtis Webb, who later became Mrs. Dranchill Hayes. Maya Curtis Webb was an excellent teacher and had a great influence over Dion Fortune's future, and Dion Fortune regarded her and Moriarty as her great teachers. Dion Fortune next moved to a lodge of the Stella Matutina, Star of the Morning, which was run by Moyena Mathers, the widow of MacGregor Mathers, one of the founders of the Golden Dawn. Moyena Mathers was another remarkable woman, very powerful, very self-opinionated, and it was inevitable that there would be a clash of personality between Moyena Mathers and Dion Fortune. Moyena Mathers was a very cultured woman, he sister of Bergson, the Norwegian philosopher. She was very attractive, vivacious, and yet something was a little odd. She married MacGregor Mathers and they agreed to have a platonic relationship, she believing that the sexual act was intrinsically unlovely. She believed that the highest part of the self could only be developed if the lower practices, as she called them, were put away. This was not an uncommon viewpoint of the age, but she had this very strange relationship with Mathers, who apparently declared to her that had she showed any signs of sexual interest, he would not only have got rid of her as a wife but thrown her out of the Golden Dawn as well. She agreed totally and appeared to have had no sexual experience whatsoever. Some of her rather violent reactions to Dion Fortune could well have come from this enormous pool of dammed up emotion, which was released when she came face to face with someone as dynamic as Dion Fortune. At this time Dion Fortune was writing some articles which would later be combined into a book, The Esoteric Philosophy of Love and Marriage. This caused an immediate reaction from Moyena Mathers, who tried to expel her for betraying the inner secrets of the order. However, when it was pointed out that Dion Fortune had no access to the fraternal information, Moyena Mathers recanted and allowed her to remain. Soon after this, Dion Fortune was writing for publication a series of articles on occult abuse, and after the essays appeared individually, they were published as Sane Occultism. Dion Fortune always maintained that she wrote better than she knew, and she was right. Some of the information did not come through the conscious mind but through her psychic faculties from inner plane sources. Unknown to her, the material she wrote involved some of her new lodge friends. On hearing of the articles, Moyena Mathers became very angry indeed and instructed Dion Fortune to withdraw them before publication. Dion Fortune considered this for some time but refused to do so on the grounds that the abuses were real and brought the occult movement into disrepute. Probably the inner source of the information she had recorded came from the Watchers, as she called them, an inner plane group who looked after the integrity of the human race. Moyinamavas wanted her to withdraw the essays she had written on the subject of abuse in the occult world and in psychic self-defense. Dion Fortune details what happened and claimed that upon her refusal to recall the articles from publication, she was viciously and astrally attacked by Moyinamavas. Dion Fortune did not advance very far up the ladder of the esoteric grades, and like Israel Regardi, author of The Complete System of the Golden Dawn, Falcon Press, Phoenix 1984, she had a low opinion of the ability of those who were supposed to be her elders and betters within the fraternity. She was fascinated by the Kabbalah and realized that in it lay the key to the Western mystery tradition. Dion Fortune found that the mundane information to which she had access was fragmentary and rather poor in quality. To satisfy herself, she was forced to spend a great amount of time researching the subject and finally wrote a Kabbalah series, which was published in the Inner Light magazine. Later this material became her well-known book, possibly the most famous of them all, The Mystical Kabbalah. Dion Fortune was only 32 at this time, a mature woman with considerable experience in practical occultism, a person who had recovered many past incarnations in detail and had acquired, or reacquired, the occult capabilities of those lives. Now she found herself in a decaying offshoot of the Golden Dawn, surrounded by ineffectual widows and greybeards. A woman of her temperament could hardly accept that. Curiously, despite her arguments with Moyinamavas, and despite the antagonism which Moyinamavas undoubtedly had for her, Dion Fortune suggested starting a lodge of the Theosophical Society, which would act as a recruiting base for Moyinamavas Alpha et Omega, which was at that time woefully short of members. It seems to have been a very curious arrangement, but one that gave Dion Fortune access to the Golden Dawn Library, and the Alpha et Omega Lodge obtained the screening source for new members. In 1922, Dion Fortune opened the Christian Mystic Lodge of the Theosophical Society in London and managed to refer to Moyinamavas a number of potential recruits. With increasing disillusionment in the Golden Dawn system, Dion Fortune became independent. Her small group of esoteric followers consisted of those she had gathered from Dr. Moriarty graduates, and some she had attracted into the Christian Mystic Lodge of the Theosophical Society. From this small and brave beginning grew her own society, the Society of the Inner Light. Next headline is The Beginning. The training Dion Fortune had received in past lives prepared her for leadership now. She was largely untrained and had little apprenticeship in other organizations. She would not have considered her current experience and awareness in any way adequate, and she once said that had she sat down and thought, she never would have started because she did not consider herself to have the required qualifications. Dion Fortune was essentially a wayshower and a builder. She was a person who could break the ground, get things going, get the group together, and then at that point, she would logically withdraw. She was the builder. Her initial group consisted mostly of retired school mistresses, ladies of uncertain age whose fathers had left them certain amounts of money, and women who had been tied to an aging and ailing mother until the mother died. Most of the group was of the middle and upper middle classes, with the class system working very strongly in England at that time. To balance it out, the group was able to recruit a couple of able-bodied men into the project, and off they started to challenge the world. This little group did most of the spade work in getting organized. It is very easy to underestimate people like this, but they were the backbone, and the work that they did enabled the group to start off on a solid foundation. Their first major project was acquiring land in Glastonbury at the foot of the Tor, and then buying an old officer's mess but from the army to erect on the property. This property was named and is still known as Chalice Orchard. Later they rented a big old house at address became the group's headquarters, and Glastonbury was used for special trans-elemental work. By now, Dion Fortune had with her a number of associates, many of whom were women of middle age, with private means who did not need to work. They followed her about in a sort of hero-worshipping condition which Dion Fortune disliked intensely. Nevertheless, she put up with it because they were good workhorses and did much of the initial work in establishing what later became known as the Society of the Inner Light. The house at No. 3 Queenborough Terrace was used as a community house for people interested in the occult, a place where they could live and work. It was referred to within the group as the community. Dionne Fortune gradually became a sort of cult figure with her very powerful personality and all those other capabilities that she had and the other ladies had not. Many of them were unmarried ladies, and this raised difficulties because of their asserting some independence in following an inner need, but the group progressed. Each of the women had a particular set of tasks assigned as her responsibility. In the early days of hard work, the members of the group became very friendly, and in turn they acquired some most curious nicknames. There was one woman, the daughter of a well-known general and the sister of another, who was a very competent organizer, and she was put in charge of household. It was she who had to organize everything to do with cooking, cleaning, services, and laundry. She was a super housekeeper and was known as Dragon First because of an imagined likeness to the picture of a dragon on a tea tray that they used, and secondly, because of her tendency to breathe fire upon anyone who would not take their dirty shoes off, or in other ways fail to observe house rules. Dragon had known and worked with Dionne Fortune from earlier days, but because Dionne Fortune considered her of low esoteric grade, Miss Lathbury never operated at the center of things. She was a small woman about 5 feet tall, fairly slight, with extremely piercing, dark brown eyes. She had a ready turn of humor and organizing abilities so enormous that it appeared that whenever she set her mind to a task, the job somehow completed itself. Another lady of an even more uncertain age, who because of her habits of dilly-dallying and failing to make decisions promptly, was known as Duda. But it should be noted that this lady, despite her shilly-shallying and peculiarities, was in fact vigorous enough to indulge in sea bailing at all times of the year, including mid-negation winter and even breaking the ice on occasions. She continued with her weekly swim even in later life. She was really an extremely hardy lady. Among her other accomplishments was the ability to translate technical Russian at very high speed. Toward the end of her life, while still within the Society of the Inner Light, she made a comfortable living translating technical documents from Russian into English. Dionne Fortune, at the time, flourished under the nickname of Fluff as she would go around the rooms detecting small pieces of dust fluff which had not been removed at cleaning. The healthy male influence came from a man who worked for the Tramways Corporation, which was a forerunner of London transport. He was a highly dedicated fellow with a strong grasp of accounting and financial principles, and an excellent organizer as well. He probably kept Dionne Fortune from the worst demands of the women, and it was he who provided a note of male stability. He was Mr. Thomas Loveyday and was known as Nibs. It was he who arranged the leasehold of No. 3 Queensborough Terrace in the early days of the group and had very much to do with Glastonbury. In fact, he ultimately died there and was buried the next to Dionne Fortune. Nibs was largely responsible for getting the affairs of the organization into order. Subsequently, a number of other men came in, but for a while it was he on whom they all depended. Nibs was also the one who bought an old army officer's mess, but in 1924, had it transported to Glastonbury and then erected it on land he acquired at the foot of the Tor. There were plenty of temporary army buildings available at that time, and many people bought them to use as holiday places by the sea or in the mountains. Meanwhile, Dionne Fortune was using Glastonbury with the little army hut, the chalet as it was called, as a focus for an increasing amount of inner plane work. In that place and with this strange group, much of the early esoteric material came through Dionne Fortune's developing mediumship. She considered Glastonbury, or Avalon as she called it, to be the holiest earth in England and considered it as a center for both an enlightened mystical Christianity and also very powerful in elemental contacts. The Tor was the center of this power. Another lesser figure was a woman known as Lummy due to her habit of using the Cockney term, when she was disturbed, of "Oh, Lummy." Her true name was Miss Lonsdale, and she occupied one of the rooms in the basement at No. 3 Queensborough Terrace, and for quite a long time she took charge of Chalice Orchard at Glastonbury. She was a comparatively insignificant figure in the esoteric life of the group, but one who was totally trustworthy and had enormous dedication. Much of the routine work fell on her and Nibs Loveyday. During the time that she was housekeeper, Members did most of the work within the house, no outsiders were allowed in because this was the phase of the closed group. Hence, she had to organize members to do anything from cleaning out drains, scrubbing kitchen floors, carpentry, painting, and so on. This she did admirably with tremendous discretion and a good sense of humor, and no matter what time a member might finish their tasks, they would always find a tray of coffee and biscuits awaiting them. Next headline is, Society of the Inner Light. Dion Fortune's original group consisted of possibly a half dozen people who worked with her in setting up the Glastonbury magical operation. When this was done, it was thought a London headquarters was needed, so they leased number 3 Queensborough Terrace, London, and subsequently bought it. Number 3 Queensborough Terrace is a typical London townhouse, Victorian or early Edwardian, a high narrow house on a tree-lined street with one end of the road abutting onto Kensington Gardens, where Dion Fortune spent quite a lot of time walking. The house was on 4 floors with a sub-basement. An access to the basement, which would have been the kitchen quarters in the old days, was gained by a short flight of steps leading down from the street. Any caller at the house would normally approach the front door by going up a short flight of steps and then through quite a large door to enter a narrow hall. On the left was a door leading to a well-proportioned room of fair size that was used as a library and for Dion Fortune's lectures as well. On this same floor were several other rooms, and at the end of the narrow passage there was a flight of stairs leading upwards and another staircase leading down to the sub-basement, where there were 4 rooms. The first 2 floors above the main level were divided into 2 rooms each, one quite large looking over the street and a smaller one to the back. On the top floor you had a labyrinth of small rooms that would once have been the servants' bedrooms. All in all, the house provided the newly formed group with plenty of space, probably a great deal more space than they needed at that time. The significant thing about the acquisition of number 3 Queensborough Terrace was that now the group had a home where they could perform steady occult work and build up a system. The only proper way of doing ritual was to have a building dedicated to that single purpose. Now they had it. The condition of the house when they moved in was appalling. There was little money, but there were eager hands, and it was remarkable what they did with soap and water, followed by a lot of paint. Number 3 Queensborough Terrace remained the group's principal headquarters from the time it was bought, sometime in 1924 or 1925, right up until 1960, when it was sold and the present quarters at 38 Steeles Road was purchased. The society was publishing a magazine now, the Inner Light Greater Than magazine, and in its pages towards the end was a small section for advertisements. One frequently appeared there advertising a bed negation sitting room at number 3 Queensborough Terrace for anyone who was sympathetic to the esoteric work of the group. They would be told that here was a place where they could live in a community atmosphere and sample something of what was going on esoterically without feeling the need to become more closely committed. This idea was very rapidly dropped for the common sense reasons that it was impossible to control people who were unsuitable, and secondly because it was difficult to get the outsiders to move when asked to leave. By eliminating all outsiders, things got under control again. After the group grew in size, was not as pinched for money, and number 3 Queensborough Terrace became better organized, they hired a full-time domestic staff. These were not members of the group but domestic servants and a cook, and the society was able to afford them well into World War II. It was only after the war that the last of the domestic staff were finally dismissed and given a formal presentation to mark their years of service. Meanwhile, the group had grown to a size of about 30. As the group grew, there were quite naturally a number of different special interest subgroups developing. Dion Fortune's aim was to have the 3 main strands of the Western tradition, the hermetic with ritual magic, the elemental or nature contact, and the devotional representing the spiritual side, all working together within the society. The inner plane adept, he told her that in order to get a balanced group, these 3 aspects must work together. The hermetic ray would synthesize the apparently complementary devotional ray on the one side and the nature ray on the other. So she started to organize subgroups within the society, with each specializing in a single path of either the elemental, devotional or hermetic. Dion Fortune was really building up three separate organizations, but it must be very carefully noted that they were not chapters or subnegation lodges or anything like that. They were merely specialized occult groups within the one organization. Fundamentally, there exists the devotional pillar and the elemental pillar with the hermetic pillar to reconcile them. But to make something like this work, you have to have a good development in all the people taking part. Dion Fortune was always aware of the shortage of time. She had this enormous pressing urge to move, almost as if she knew that her life would be a comparatively short one. Consequently, she was building up the society as fast as she could, feeling that she had to get a structure of some sort going, and that she could correct the deficiencies and problems afterwards. She was not able to do this, and these ideal conditions for the three rays to manifest were not realized at that time. Like many people of her stature and intelligence, Dion Fortune was a bit naive as far as human nature was concerned. She failed to appreciate that these subgroup people would want to build up an organization of their own to practice the nature A within these specialized conditions, and would tend to develop a sort of internal hierarchy of their own. What happened within the Society of the Inner Light was the development of three rather uncomfortable bedfellows, and it finally got to the point where people working with the nature ray would not talk to those working with the devotional ray, who in turn, would not talk to the hermetic ray people, and vice versa. This certainly points to an underdevelopment of the group's structure, and the problems it caused had not been satisfactorily reconciled by the time she died in 1946. The problems were temporarily reconciled by World War II, 1939-45, because many activities had to stop as a number of the members were away in the services. The war shook them all up and harmony was temporarily restored, but Dion Fortune was never actually able to reconcile the concept of developing all three rays. The thing to note here is that there never were any schisms or offshoots of the society, and there never were any mandates given to open other lodges of the Society of the Inner Light. It was always one central operation, and the only operating lodge was centered in London. Glastonbury was simply a specialist operation where people went to do certain work, mostly connected with the nature ray and sometimes with the devotional ray. The nearest Dion Fortune got to specialized sub-organizations were these three rather uncomfortable subgroups within the society itself. Dion Fortune was completely against the idea of having chapters and mandates to open other lodges, because she had seen the abuse that had occurred within the Golden Dawn organization. In some instances, persons only scantily qualified were empowered to open Golden Dawn lodges in some distant part of the United Kingdom, and it was extremely difficult to keep one's finger on what these semi-official lodges were doing. Under the right circumstances, the concept would work well and could develop into a healthy group, but often the emphasis was more on maintaining numbers than developing quality. Consequently, many chapters of the Golden Dawn system deteriorated to where, in one instance, two of the officers, a husband and wife, engaged in a full-scale family squabble in the middle of one of Dion Fortune's initiations in the Golden Dawn system. Frequently, a number of candidates were initiated together and stumbled over each other due to untrained officers who were unfamiliar with the ritual. Dion Fortune's organization was always well disciplined and had a standard of ritual that was effective, efficient, and produced results. She had raised the whole magical procedure several levels. The purpose of the Society of the Inner Light was originally twofold. The first was to train people from the standpoint of regeneration so that they could become better examples of what they ought to be and hence have an effect directly on the world. The second objective was to direct a propaganda organization to produce literature and books, to offer lectures about the work, and to spread the word in a manner that could be clearly understood by the public at large. However, once the society got going and the inner plane contacts were established, the adepti quite plainly stated that, "We are not going to spend a lot of time and trouble playing around with you, we want results. We are going to use you, and in the process you will get developed." It was not to be a mutual admiration society with people sitting around going in for a bit of self-development. Thus the purpose of the organization tended to change. The regeneration part was obviously necessary, but the propaganda part was largely withdrawn apart from the books Dion Fortune wrote. The Inner Plane Adepti placed an enormous stress upon regeneration of the group consciousness and upon talismanic and magical action. The bias and stress of the group had now passed over from propaganda to the magical regeneration of the group mind.